we were discussing Genesis chapter 3, the fall into sin. And we had gotten into a discussion of number 2, the details of the fall. And I had discussed A and B, the nature of the test and the serpent. So we begin at C. That's all on your outline sheet. The details of the fall, which is capital C, number 2, and then small c, is where we pick up, which is the process of surrender. So Genesis chapter 3, the process of surrender. I think there are a number of steps involved when you reflect on the narrative there about the temptation of Eve by the serpent. First, you read there's injection of doubt in 3:1, where you read the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals which God had made. He said to the woman, did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden? There's injection of doubt. Satan raises a question. Did God really say that you must not eat from any tree in the garden? The implication of the question is that God is not loving and good. Is God somebody that doesn't allow you to do a harmless thing like eating from that tree? There's sort of an insinuation, I think, implied in the question. Did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden? The second step in the process is the woman comes to God's defense. But it appears that as she does that, she sharpens the prohibition. Now, I don't know if you can be dogmatic about this, but it appears that that's what she does. In verse 2, the woman said to the serpent, we may eat from the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God did say, you must not eat from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it or you will die. That last phrase, you must not touch it, is not something that is reported to us in 2:17. 2:17 says, you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you will surely die. When she responds, she says, God said, you must not eat from the tree that's in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it, or you will die. In other words, she adds that, sharpening the prohibition. Now, you can perhaps read too much onto that, but it seems to me that that betrays an attitude of resentment or irritation on the part of Eve, in the sense that God here is a bit too severe, perhaps. Why does he do this? I don't know how many of you have young children, but you'll see that kind of reaction often in young children. You'll tell them they're not to do such and such a thing. They resent it, and then they make it all the more strict or rigid as they express that resentment and distort it in that way. What it's really expressing, though, is the resentment or the irritation at being restricted. There may be something of that here. I wouldn't be dogmatic about it, but certainly in the comparison of the statement in 3:2 with the prohibition, there is that addition that may then reflect irritation or resentment on her part, that God is being too severe. The third step is Satan, in verse 4, flatly accuses God of being false. He comes out and he says, you will not surely die, the serpent said to the woman, for God knows. Well, I'm jumping ahead to verse 5. Verse 4 is, you will not surely die. It's a direct attack on God's veracity and integrity. God said you will die. Satan says you won't die. The fourth step is in verse 5. Because in verse 5, Satan goes on to a mixture of truth and falsehood. He says, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. There's a mixture of truth and falsehood, which is often worse than outright falsehood. It's hard to sort out. What Satan says in verse 5 is true, but it's not to man's advantage, as he implies that it would be. When you eat of it, your eyes will be opened. You will be like God. Now, in 3:22, the end of the chapter, we looked at that verse earlier in another connection. You can see that what Satan said there was true. God says, after the fall, in 22, the man has now become like one of us, knowing good and evil. But you see, the implication is that that is something that's desirable and good, when actually what it amounts to is Adam and Eve's usurping, as we discussed earlier, the significance of the name, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, the place that was rightfully only God's, the determiner of values and what was right and what was wrong. So that Satan implies that it's to their advantage when actually it isn't. So there's a mixture of truth and falsehood. The fifth step. Verse 6, when the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. And what you find in verse 6 is that the woman's human reasoning, based on Satan's arguments, lead her to sin. The woman's human reasoning, based on Satan's arguments, lead her to sin. I think the process here was one of gradual surrender, you might say. But ultimately, when she takes the fruit and eats, she oversteps that bound. She violates the prohibition that God had given to her and really sets herself up of the norm of determining good and evil, right and wrong. And claim that autonomy that properly belongs to God alone. 1 John 2:6, or excuse me, 2:16, is an interesting verse in connection with Genesis 3. First John 2:16 says, "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world passeth away in the lust of it. But he that doeth the will of God abideth forever." You have the lust of the flesh mentioned in John 2:16, the sensual aspect of man, the bodily appetite. And if you look back at verse 6, the woman saw the fruit of the tree was good for food. The sensual aspect of man, his bodily appetite. And then in 1 John 2:16, you have the lust of the eyes, the aesthetic aspect of man. And in 3:6, you read the fruit was pleasing to the eye. And then the intellectual aspect, desirable for gaining wisdom. And in John, you have the pride of life, the pride of life, that intellectual aspect, it is good or desirable for gaining wisdom. So those three aspects, sensual, aesthetic, and intellectual aspects, seem to combine here in this reasoning that led her to take the fruit. All right, the sixth and last step is at the end of verse 6. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. So Adam also took and ate. John Murray, in his notes on this passage in some lectures, suggests that the easiest way to overcome a man is through the woman he loves and esteems. And there may have been something of that at work here. Certainly Adam was responsible, and the rest of Scripture makes that clear. But it's through Eve that he's led to sin. So there's a gradual process. Now you can, you know, theoretically go back over that process and reflect on it and ask the question, when did sin actually take place? When did Eve sin? I don't know if you can nail that down. Certainly by the time she took the fruit in the overt act, she clearly violated the commandment. But she may have sinned prior to that in her reasoning, in her mind. Murray suggests that sin took place at the point at which there was the sympathetic entertainment of the serpent's suggestions. At the point where there was the sympathetic entertainment of the serpent's suggestions. In other words, he comes, and instead of Eve saying, "Look, the Lord has spoken, I'm going to obey the Lord." Instead of that, she says, "Well, maybe you're right." At that point where she sympathetically entertains the serpent's suggestions, Murray feels there was sin. He doesn't think you can specify that. You can't be absolutely sure. It's precisely where that occurred. It may go back as far as her first answer. When she says, "We may eat from the fruit of the trees of the garden," or when she says at the end of verse 2, "Neither must you touch it." It may go back that far, but that's hard to say, I think, with certainty. In any case, you have a process of surrender. D is the suddenness of the result. The process was gradual. The result was sudden. And you find that immediately in the seventh verse. Because you read, as soon as Adam also took of the fruit, the next statement in verse 7 is, "The eyes of them both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves aprons." So the first thing with respect to the suddenness of the result is the shame of nakedness. Verse 7. Their eyes were opened. Now you remember, Satan said in verse 5, "God knows that in the day you eat, your eyes will be opened. And you will be as God, knowing good and evil." And you find they eat, and the first thing the text says is, the eyes of them were opened. However, what you find is an awareness of nakedness that had not been present before. I don't think this means, and I think we should be very firm about this, that this was the origin of sexual consciousness. There have been those who have argued that. It isn't until after the fall that there is an awareness of sexual consciousness. I don't think we can say that sexuality and sexual consciousness came into being because of sin. Sexuality and sexual consciousness are not sinful or the result of sin. God had said to Adam before the fall, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth." And there's no reason to think that this is the origin of sexual consciousness. But you do have an awareness of shame and nakedness that arises at the point of sin. And I think what that tells us is that now there's a marred or distorted relationship between Adam and Eve that wasn't present before. And I think what that reflects is ultimately the distortion of all human relationships because of sin. If you go back to 2:25, you read they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. But now it's all changed. They know that they're naked, and now they sew fig leaves, make themselves aprons. And I think what this reflex of shame that arises as a result of sin points to is the destruction of harmony and purity in the relationship between Adam and Eve. That which initially had been there when in their sinless condition is now gone. And of course, in a wider sense, I think it's indicative of alienation between man and his fellow man, whether that be male or female, because of sin. There's distorted relationships. Question?
Yes, I mean, fine word question, what are you talking about back and forth between two people? Are you talking about
on that? How did I didn't even realize you used the word. How did I use it? What did I say?
Uh, citizens who reflexive to the citizens. I just heard you say it, and I read it here.
I think what I would say, I think shame is a reflex, if you want. Maybe that's not a good term to use. You know, what is shame? If you think about it, sort of an emotional kind of feeling that is triggered by something. I think it's a feeling that arises from a consciousness of guilt. It can have various causes. You can be, you know, it can be shame because of nakedness. It can be shame for a whole variety of other things that may trigger a sense of shame, but it seems to be related to a sense of guilt. Here, it's associated with exposure of the body, which is... I think so. Animals don't have it, as far as we know. I think it also, though, it's a very complex thing because it's also related to culture and upbringing. You know, in some cultures, shame is almost non-existent as far as nakedness is concerned because of the way in which the culture treats that. But it does seem normally that there is a sense of shame for nakedness as well as for other things. It's related to a sense of guilt. So reflex, I think, in that sense. But to get back to this question of what is the significance of the awareness of nakedness immediately after the fall? I would just suggest that after the fall, man has a fallen nature. He's basically oriented towards sin as a result of the fall. That causes him to seek to exploit his fellow man. That becomes the natural human reaction of the fallen nature, seeking to exploit his fellow man. And I don't think that's anywhere more readily seen than in the sexual relationship. Attempt to exploit another person. When you get into the sexual relationship, that becomes a very real danger. And so what we find is the relationship between Adam and Eve is not pure as it was before, and they experience shame as a reflex of their guilt. There's the use of that term again, reflex. But then the reverse side of that is shame is also a blessing. It may come as a result of sin and a sense of guilt, but it's also a blessing because it protects from moral danger. So it has a positive function. I think we can say that shamelessness encourages sexual exploitation of the other person. We have a lot of that in our society. And it encourages sexual exploitation. Shame protects from that. So I think we can say that shame here, as well as later in the chapter, clothing, are given by God as a means for keeping a proper relationship between the sexes in a fallen world. Now, if we reflect on this a bit further, it seems to me that where true love rules, and that's a loaded term today, true love in a biblical sense, where that rules, and where there's a desire to obey God on the part of two individuals in a marriage relationship, that function of shame can fall away to a great extent. And you can approach back to what it was in 2:25. They were both naked, man and his wife were not ashamed. But only where true love in the biblical sense rules and where there's a desire to obey God does that function fall away without becoming shamelessness. And it seems to me that in that circumstance, within the marriage relationship, that condition prior to the fall can be approached, but never perfectly realized. in the fallen world. So you have a very significant thing happening here. It's striking that the first thing that's said after the fall is the eyes of them were opened, they knew that they were naked. Secondly, question. It seems to me that there's a larger question that addressed here. That is, there's alienation between Adam and Eve. That alienation, with the tendency towards exploitation, is seen perhaps as clearly in the sexual relationship as it is anywhere else. And so that becomes the thing that immediately is focused on here. But I think the issue is a much broader issue. And it, you know, the thing with Noah and his sons, even though it's not male and female, it's quite possible that there was some sort of perverted sexual